This is ensemble member James Vincent Meredith, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
Hey everyone, I'm Aaron Carter, literary manager. Welcome to the Steppenwolf podcast. This is the second installment of our new format in which we're imagining the podcast as an extension of our public square events. We'll be bringing you artist interviews, panel discussions, lectures, all in an effort to enrich your experience with the work on our stages. Recently, I had the opportunity to sit down with Edna Walsh, the playwright of Penelope. The interview was one of the most enjoyable writer chats I've had. Edna is charming, funny, and quietly brilliant. Talking with him changed how I watched the play. As a literary manager, I'm often working with brand new plays on their way to world premieres. Penelope, by contrast, has been produced several times, and it was fascinating to hear a playwright talk about his work with the benefit of that perspective. There's a sense in our chat that the time away from the piece has altered his relationship with it. Instead of trying to figure out the play before its first production, Enda seemed to be able to sit back and let the play tell him what it was about. We started our conversation in the usual spot, how Enda got his start in theater. You know, I'd love to know simple stuff, like, you know, you're kind of a globe-trotting playwright right now, so how'd you get started in the whole playwriting thing?
My mom initially was an actress. I come from a family of six kids. My mom was an actress, but I'm the second last kid, but by the time I came around, she'd given it up because she was populating the world with Walsh's and busy doing that. So there was something obviously genetically sort of in there, and a disposition that many Irish people sort of have of just actually talking, of just talking the hell out of stuff, and so that was there sort of in the family all the time. I studied film in college.
Where was that?
In Dublin. Okay. It was sort of back in the 80s, you know, when there was no film industry, so I sort of likened to sort of studying dentistry in a country where there's no teeth. It was just completely ludicrous sort of notion of doing it. And it was full of very, very sort of, you know, like, you know, I thought quite sort of like, you know, black polar neck sort of pretentious sort of types. And I was from the north side of the city, so I wasn't this sort of, you know, they're all a bit sort of much more middle class than even what I was, you know. Mm-hmm. I flunked out of college and ended up, you know, going, well, working as a film editor for a while, and then going, well, what I really want to do is try and write. And I'd written short stories when I was 15.
So how'd you get from short stories to plays?
I think it was sort of like, it just seemed like, I as a boy, I was in the sort of the Dublin Youth Theatre, and I sort of went there to, you know, like, you know, I was a Saturday club sort of carry on. And my mom was very sort of, you know, clever, sort of sending me sort of there. She thought, you know, I was a little bit, tiny bit sort of shy, but it sort of, it, you know, I liked being around those sort of people, did stage management and mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff. But while I was there, immediately sort of felt much more home on stage and, you know, could improvise the crap out of anything. And started writing and reading plays for the first time when I was, I suppose, before I went to college. So I was like, you know, about, you know, 16 or so.
What was your breakout play? When did you start getting noticed as a playwright?
I wrote a play called The Ginger Ale Boy, which was sort of a year before my real breakout play, I suppose, which was Disco Pigs. But I wrote The Ginger Ale Boy, and which was this story of a ventriloquist who has a nervous breakdown and thinks that dogs are going to eat him. And it's sort of like, but it was hugely sort of flawed, of course, you know, like, and I was aping, like, you know, some really sort of fucking rough and tumble sort of writers, and it wasn't all there, but I performed it myself because I still sort of thought, actually, maybe I'll try and be an actor, you know. But it worked, and it's sort of like the Arts Council. I fell in with this group, this theatre company in Cork, and you know, we lived on you know Guinness and packets of crisps, and you know, we're effectively on the dole, but we were making work in a tiny, tiny little theatre. Mm-hmm. But the theatre gave us the space to work in. There was about sort of 12 of us, and we would sort of create work all the time. And I became the designated writer, and because I figured I just actually liked it. I liked sort of like, you know, handing bits of paper, you know,
paper and sort of seeing what that would sort of do and whether people would be interested and trying to sort of construct larger and larger pieces. So I used to write really small pieces, like 5-minute plays, and it gets a little bit bigger. And then eventually I wrote The Ginger Ale Boy, which was this sort of 2-hour play with an interval. And, you know, like and a real sort of feat for me, you know, like to manage to do it. And then afterwards, we continued as a company. We got, Ginger Ale Boy got us huge sort of recognition. Well, big recognition. We suddenly got Arts Council money and to you know, for a year. And so we could sort of survive and get off the crisps and eat actually sort of like, you know, vegetables and, you know, meat and things like that.
So you were really moving up in the world.
We were really moving up.
Excellent,
yeah.
Excellent.
And then I wrote The Disco Pigs, and that sort of like sort of began, you know, that really launched, I suppose, everything.
Excellent. So you mentioned early in there that part of your development was, you know, the fact that, if I may paraphrase, you know, Irish folk like to talk.
Yeah.
So do you see yourself as a Irish playwright in that kind of grand tradition that, you know, that we in the States are familiar with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have you carry around all those playwrights with you, and it is, the writer is, you know, still recognized in Ireland, and people sort of like, you know, they like the fact that there's this huge sort of like writing tradition and da da da. You know, when I sit down and write a play, you've got the sort of strains of other playwrights in your heads, those Irish playwrights in your heads, and those great plays. And, you know, I'm happy. I can sort of, and I can look back, and, you know, I don't sort of stand over my plays a lot of the time, but I look back at them and go, oh, I can see the sort of strains of Tom Murphy and Beckett and, you know, like, and people like that, you know, like that. That's just in your sort of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I spent a lot of time in after Disco Pigs and the sort of that success there, you know, it suddenly, I was like around Europe a lot and seeing sort of European sort of the shape of their plays, and that affected, you know, me greatly, I suppose.
And is that how you got connected with the German company that ended up commissioning Penelope?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I met like when I was like 16 years ago during Disco Pigs, that first thing. I met Tilman Rapka, who became my sort of on-off dramaturg, who sort of really helped me. Not that I didn't, not that I needed help, but sometimes, you know, like it's sort of important that you just don't completely disappear, you know, like into pfft. So yeah, with Penelope, he was the one who sort of who hooked me up with that.
So how did Penelope start for you? What was the impetus for this piece?
Well, it was a commission with Tilman, and he ended up working in Oberhausen in the Ruhr Valley, which is a small theater. But he's this wandering sort of like dramaturg, and basically there's a bunch of European playwrights, you know, like Jan Fossen did others, you know, who will actually sort of always follow Tilman to where is he at and try and work with him in some sort of way. So he ended up in Oberhausen, and this area was doing. They wanted to do the Odyssey, and Oberhausen was twinned with four other cities, smaller cities in the area. So the whole area was this area of culture, European area of culture. So the five cities sort of got together, and they said, "Well, let's, you know, ask five playwrights to take on the Odyssey." And I was one of them, five European playwrights. And Tilman came to me and said, "Well, do you fancy it? And these are the other people who are writing." Da 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 da. And what do you fancy? And I said, I want to do The Suitors. I can remember from as a boy, I always found them very sort of funny and found them desperate. And their situation just seemed so right for my work. You know, that's those people who are just, you know, who just imprison themselves and have actually have forgotten why the hell they're there almost, you know, but they're there. And they're trying to sort of figure out their lives. And it just seemed, straight away, I went over to Tilman, and we had like a day in a pub where he drank and I talked, and basically I sort of trashed out, sort of like belted out the play, the strains of the play with him, the smells of it, the notion of men, 11 o'clock in the morning, in Speedos, at the bottom of the swimming pool, drinking cocktails, awaiting their death. Seemed like, you know, a really sort of a comic sort of beginning to an ultimately sort of tragic sort of thing.
So from that initial impulse, did you just anything surprise you as you developed the piece, as you dug into it? Were you surprised by any direction it took?
I suppose I can't really sort of remember, you know, whether being, but it became, in hindsight, it became a much more personal piece than what I imagined it was going to be.
How so? And
it sort of, it became about, I think I've got huge problems with the fact that I'm not as good as what I should be in terms of being a human being. And so I'm looking at it and I'm going, oh yeah, actually, that's what the piece sort of seems to be about. It seems to be about, like, the hero's journey within it is actually these guys trying to undo their fucked up lives in some sort of way, you know, trying to clean up everything that they've sort of left behind. And so in looking back in it, I can see actually there's a conversation that I'm obviously having with myself in terms of going, you know, I'm really unhappy about the way that I've sort of like spent a lot of my life, but I think that's actually just part of the journey. It's never, I never feel completely rested. I was trying to sort of, you know, trying to get things better.
How did you first get connected with Amy Morton, the director, and Steppenwolf?
I think they saw my work in they saw the Woolworth Forest in the National Theatre at the time when August Osage County was in the National, and I of course knew of the company for ever, like whatever, for like, you know, great American theatre. And was a fan of Tracy's, and so saw August Osage County, and then hooked up with sort of Tracy really recently. This March in Washington, there was a season of my work in this theater, and they were there with Virginia Woolf, so I got to sort of like you know at least talk to them after sort of seeing them on stage or reading their books or la 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 la. And it was very sort of sweet of them. And even at that stage, I'd known that Steppenwolf were interested in doing Penelope. And I was, you know, excited to see, you know, well, what they would sort of do with it, you know.
So have you seen Penelope with American actors before?
No.
So how do you find it?
In
that contrast with, I assume you've seen it with Irish and European cast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
it's sort of like it's in terms of like it's a bit of a sort of shock for me to hear it in English and not in Irish. You know, like to go, whoa, right, all that sort of thing. But of course, you quickly sort of adjust to that, and then you begin to sort of see actually just the crazy shape of the piece, because you know there's a distance from me from the piece, and go, oh my God, this is a really, really dangerous piece. Because I can remember actually in writing it, and I'd never had this experience really before of feeling, or maybe I have done, but really I felt as if the characters didn't have any direction. There was no future. The characters were sort of, they were like walking in the dark. So there's no sense of, although we know that these men are going to face their deaths in an hour and a half's time, there's no sense of actually sort of how the hell they're going to get there. And that was interesting. And when I was looking at it last night, I was reminded by that. I was going, God, this is hugely dangerous. This is like, I mean, it's very, very much in the second. They're sort of acting sort of like on their impulse right now, but there's no sense of the next minute. You know, do you know what I mean by that?
I do. And so what do you find dangerous about that?
Well, it just is, because I suppose sort of built in as an audience, you have a sense sometimes, you know, like of shape, mm-hmm. you know, of, you know, like how the shape is gonna sort of work in. It's something that we learn as an audience. But this thing feels completely sort of shapeless. And for all of that, just feels like being created in the second, mm-hmm. you know, being created in the moment, you know, as I suppose it's probably true. If I knew that I was going to die in an hour, if I knew I was going to die in an hour and a half, my senses would be pretty much up, wouldn't they? Our senses would be as, and everything would be a bit like, fuck, right, okay, what are we doing? And, you know, and all this sort of business.
Without that kind of traditional shape to it, what do you feel is hooking the audience and carrying them moment to moment?
Anxiety.
that's
what I saw last night. I think it's sort of anxiety and also sort of analysis. You know, I mean, there's a great deal of analysis that's going on in the moment with those characters. You know, faced with their deaths, they're going, well, who the hell are we? You know, what are we doing here? You know, like, and knowing that they've crushed, you know, for years, they've crushed this notion of love, that they go about actually trying to construct planets. Now that surprised me, you know, like that they were going, okay, we've killed this planet. Right, now see if I can imagine another place where I can actually place myself. The first 20 minutes I was talking to Amy, I was reminded the first 20 minutes are so dangerous in that as an audience you're thinking, this is it? It's like a sitcom. It's like a really bad sitcom. The bottom of a swimming pool where these men are talking the last conversations. They've got nothing else to say. It's like sort of vocabulary is just sort of going. And then they learn of their sort of, they're united by a dream and a sort of prophecy that, you know, they're going to die. And then it's like all the old words are gone and now they must find new words. They must actually now begin to sort of wake up.
I've been doing post-show discussions with folks, so mm-hmm. so lots of interesting questions have been coming up during our post-show discussions. You know, and one of the things that you know, some people have been curious about is, you know, Penelope, the play is called Penelope, uh-huh. yet she never speaks.
Yeah.
The focus seems to be on the four suitors. Yeah. So why did it end up being called Penelope?
It seemed like, well, it ended up being Penelope because, well, first of all, I mean, I knew that I was beginning with the suitors. I knew that Penelope was going to be in it. I didn't know that she wasn't going to talk. But I knew that primarily the sort of the guys were going to sort of, it was going to be about their relationships. And Penelope just seemed like such a delicate sort of lady name to to call what was sort of effectively some men in speedo slopping around at like sort of dead fish at the bottom of the swimming pool. It seemed, you know, the opposite to all of that.
So you like the contrast?
I like the contrast. So, but I didn't know that she wasn't going to talk, and I presumed that she was going to talk, and it didn't, and it surprised me. And when I got to the end, I went, oh my God, she has not talked. And that's the way sort of like, you know, I sort of experienced it. But in sort of afterwards, I sort of felt as if, and I can sort of see that it's, you know, all her love and sort of longing for her husband, everything is sort of being discussed. Love is sort of like all being churned up in the air and all this sort of business by these four voices. And it seemed to me, I suppose sort of in hindsight, that actually the love that she had for him was all the stronger because of the sort of silence and needed it to be. It couldn't be done in words. It couldn't be done with sort of like, yeah, with all the sort of, you know, the machinations of the poetry and da-da-da and all that type of bit. It wasn't, that was all sort of in the ether, but it could never come out of her mouth. You know, like it just didn't seem right. It wasn't about words for her, you know. Mm-hmm. Just that look for me just seemed to be enough. And I know that with a really great actress, that's more than I can sort of do. And it's more than sort of 3-page bloody monologue can do. Anything like that, you know, do you know what I mean? And that sort of, that seemed to me to be sort of like much stronger.
You know, another thing that's come up in these post-show discussions is, you know, the play, well, I was about to say the play closes with a murder, but it doesn't, it's not quite the last thing that happens, but there is a killing near the end of the work.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are really wrestling with believing that the three suitors who carry out the killing are doing so in an attempt to be better people.
Yeah.
And yet the mechanism by which they try to redeem themselves is violence.
Exactly.
And so people seem to be, you know, really struggling with that, I think, in an interesting way. I mean, is that something that...
I think it's sort of like years of behavior and the way they were, and you cannot undo that. You can't undo, you know, like, you know, the men that they really, really are. They're striving for something sort of else and something sort of, you know, something like a piece of beauty. But they still are these physical sort of animals. Mm. I mean, they're sloppy animals, lazy, ignorant, retarded, sort of, you know, like blah. But yet, they're sort of, they want to be better than that. But, you know, like, I mean, them killing another guy isn't a big deal for them. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like, that's done, but actually they want something else. Mm. It's sort of part of the language of, you know, there were 100 men, I think, in the play. It's as though the notion of 100 men living on that island. And you know, week by week, someone's topping themselves because they're going, this is useless, this is pointless. What are we doing here? We've given up our whole life for something, for this prize. we've forgotten our families, we've forgotten, you know, like everyone, our businesses, and we're waiting for this woman's recognition. It's never going to sort of come. So people are killing themselves. So this sort of, this language of just death sort of thing, of doing that, it's in the air, I think.
Do you think there's anything that audiences should know before they come into the show? Is there anything
I don't know. I mean, I think there was some sort of discussion a long time ago, whenever it's been done before, people were going, should we talk about the fact of where it's come from and all that type of thing? I said, oh, I don't know. Or
you don't think people need to, you know, be familiar, remember the Odyssey before encountering
I don't think so, but I mean, it sort of helps, you know, because I think there's sort of, there's references and there's certainly sort of smells of, like, you know, sort of tonally, sort of like a little bit of the Odyssey, I feel.
Do you think there's anything particularly Irish about the play that American audiences might not pick up?
I don't think so either. I mean, because it's sort of, it seems like, to me, it seems, you know, it's just about, it feels like it's just about men. You know, and men are men are men, you know, it doesn't matter where they're from or whatever, you know. I mean, there's the whole sort of like economic sort of collapse of Ireland and all that type of thing, which America knows sort of its own sort of, you know, collapse, you know, and it was written at a time of in 2008 or whatever, you know, or the beginning of the writing was sort of then, or the thinking of it was around then. And, you know, all of that was in the air, and that was sort of about men who've, you know, desperate men who've, like, ruined our country and smashed it into the ground and were sort of, like, you know, hated and despised by the whole society for, you know, how they basically, you know, just smashed the country into a hole.
And so do you see the Suitors as reminiscent of those men who smashed the country?
I think so, yeah. I think I get that. I mean, I sort of, they are not just those men. They're men who've, like, wasted their lives.
So each of the men, each of the Suitors, tries to woo Penelope, each in their own style, which is pretty entertaining. Have you ever tried to woo someone? Are you a troubadour, a poet?
No, I'm terrible. I completely looked out and got my wife, like, you know, like, who's an extraordinary sort of beautiful, brilliant woman. But I don't know. I might have wooed her with drugs. I think that was possibly it. Just the good old-fashioned way. Rohypnol. I mean,
I'm sure there was more to it.
Just so there wasn't. There was drink and drugs. That was.
So how did? Just so you can redeem yourself, how did you two meet?
We met in the Traverse Theatre. We met, like, you know, like in my first hit, like Disco Pigs, was sort of in the Traverse. And she was working there at the time. She was right out of college working in the box office. So I scored.
Classic theater romance. What's the next project for you?
A couple of things, but I'm into sort of, well, I have to do sort of a couple of movies at the moment. So I think there's going to be movies for a bit, but stage-wise, I'm going to make a version of the Trapani Opera with John Tiffany and Stephen Hoggart for the National, I think. All things going well, I think that will be probably the next thing.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks for hanging out and talking with us, and goodbye.
Absolute pleasure.
Our production of Penelope was my introduction to Enda Walsh's writing. Working on the play and talking with him has made me a fan and eager to see what he does next. Now you've heard the interview, so come see the play. You've got one more week to see our production of Penelope. Check it out. I'll be back to talk with you about The March, based on the book by E.L. Doctorow and adapted and directed by ensemble member Frank Galati. Thanks for listening.